I'm Lily.
I'm Lorraine.
And we're caffeinated on the train. So, how have you been, Lorraine? What's new?
I've been busy.
Been busy.
Shocking.
No surprise. It's officially the end of Capricorn season. Oops. Will Lorraine become less busy?
No.
Lorraine is Capricorn season embodied.
I do my best. I had a lot of deadlines in the past week. And the one I'm most excited about was the deadline for edits on an article I wrote for the Horror Scholar Journal, which is like a little indie semi-academic journal.
Cool.
And the issue I was contributing to was all about Hannibal Lecter.
You never told me about this, you know?
It's because we're not recording every week anymore.
It's true. Somehow this one fell through the cracks.
I'm so sorry. I thought I must
have
it somewhere.
Please, do tell.
I wrote an article about the 2013 series Hannibal. Actually, this is, I want to talk to you in more detail about this because it was a very fun article to write.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, it was about, did you ever watch the show? No. Well, there's a young female character in it who is the daughter of a serial killer. And spoiler alert for Hannibal in 2013, in case you you were planning on catching up.
Yeah, about Hannibal in whatever year that movie first came out.
It's, yeah.
I don't know. 90s Hannibal?
Anyway. Yes. Maybe even earlier?
Maybe even earlier.
The books are from...
Anyway.
We'll
leave it in the description in the book.
Yes. Maybe.
There's a musical.
It's a musical. It's called Silence the Musical.
How does that work? Fine. We'll leave more information in the description.
Or we'll take this whole part out.
Yeah.
Anyway, spoiler alert for the 2013 Hannibal series. But this girl is also a murderer.
She also a cannibal?
Yes.
Yes, it's genetic.
Well,
not enough research done on cannibalism and genetic.
This is in fact part of the conflict of the show. And what I wrote about was how difficult it is for people who are consuming media to hold in their heads the idea that she is a victim and also a murderer at the same time.
Wow, that's awesome. That sounds really, really cool.
Thank you.
As soon as the journal goes out,
we will link it. It's like open access.
Amazing. Yeah. I want to read that. That's really cool. And that's a really important theme.
I think so, too.
I think you're using literature in a way I approve of, or media, too. Yeah.
Yeah, I do my best.
Yeah, you're doing well.
Thank you.
You're getting my endorsement.
Oh, good.
My prestigious podcast endorsement.
The journal, the way that the journal pays for itself is it sells advertising space. We should sell a coat advertising.
We should sell a coat advertising space. Speaking of that, here's our plug, one of many, for our Patreon. Please support women in academia. That's our new tagline, support women in academia.
Young women.
Young women in academia. Yeah, hashtag young women in academia.
Hashtag please support young women in academia. Hashtag coat podcast.
Hashtag support. Hashtag pay us. Thanks.
Link to our Patreon in the description.
What were we saying? How does this journal pay for itself? Advertising space.
Yes.
Right.
Which, you know, this is a side note, so I'm going to keep it really short, but I was looking at other open access journals, and they charge authors to submit to them. Like, if you get picked, you have to pay.
Yeah, I think you maybe tweeted about this.
I did.
What the fuck? Bleep that. Maybe I'm actually doing this one anyway. I'll know how to leave.
Just note to yourself. It's frankly ridiculous and unreasonable that academic journals think the only two ways to pay for themselves are to either make authors pay a disgusting amount or make subscribers pay a disgusting amount. When you can, in fact, sell a spot in your journal for advertisers like the whole rest of the publishing industry does.
Yeah.
Rant ends there.
Truly. I mean, what was I going to say? I had something to say also about... I was just going to say, that's almost as ridiculous as charging tuition for university. Am I right? Crazy. Make us pay for university?
For what?
Insane. You don't have to. You don't have to do that.
Come to Germany.
Come to Germany. It's free. You don't have to do anything special. We don't. We're nothing special. We're just.
Well, I mean, we are.
Yeah.
We have a podcast.
Who we? anyway.
So what I did in this last week was make the edits for this wonderful journal that I'm very excited about being part of.
Very well done, and reining that back in. Nice job. We need reins. We need harnesses.
You know,
handcuffs.
Rain is a very appropriate nickname for Lorraine.
Yeah, it truly is. It's nice. It's like one day when you already have long flowing hair. You're just gonna end up being like this old hippie woman living in some town like Ithaca or New Paltz, New York, and you're gonna go by Rain, and you're gonna wear tie dye.
Ah, yes. Yeah. But also a harness.
Also hard. Same time.
Yeah.
Obviously. Duh. Yeah. So that's a bright future, you know? People act like the world is coming to an end, but not for Lorraine. That's what you want, you know? Like, yeah. Wearing like artisanal jewelry. It's gonna be good.
All of this is getting better.
Discussing your nickname when you're old.
I saw an ad on Instagram for someone who crochets BDSM gear.
That's gonna be you. That's your retirement hobby.
Truly.
I wanna see that. I wanna see.
I'll send you a link.
Please, link in the description.
Link in the description.
Lily, what's what have I been doing? So this last week was quite intense, to be honest. Like it's reaching full resolution tomorrow. It will have been 1 week since basically I have been engaged in a pretty long drawn out process applying via the direct exchange program to study in Mexico City, and the process, I have to say, you know, I've applied for a lot of different things in my life, and this has been pretty intensive, what it has asked of me. And one of the things that it asked of me is that I needed to take a Spanish placement exam and present a language certificate that my Spanish reaches the standards necessary for me to be, by their judgment, be able to study at the University of Ciudad Mexico. And so I took that, and it was very intense experience. I don't feel, to be honest, amazing about how the exam went. I find out tomorrow how it went, whether I got the necessary grade that I needed. But the other thing was that the application itself was due also last week, and I submitted all the documents. It's interesting because half of what I end up doing on like the last day, which took me a really long time, is I personally, I'm not so into details and, you know, fine tuning the CV, like the formatting and like proofreading my letter and
proofreading. Who
does
that?
Yeah, seriously. Oh my God. But the thing is, this is it. When I was in high school, when I applied to college and submitted my essay on whatever the fuck that. That website where you submit your all your college applications. I've repressed this because it's bad. I applied to a lot of very prestigious universities and was rejected from all of them. And I reread my college essay and found a lot of typos in it. And that scarred me for life. I'll be frank with you. So I'm very paranoid about proofreading, although I hate it. It's a miserable 5 minutes while I'm proofreading, let's just say. I'm deeply uncomfortable, and not in like a fun way, not in like a fun, sexy way. anyway, so deeply bored and unstimulated way. I probably don't even do a very good job because I'm really just floating over the words. Like I'm reading every fifth word probably, to be honest. I think that I just black out during most of the proofreading. Wake up. Have an email that I submitted it. Anyway, anyone's guess. But no, I mean, these kind of applications oftentimes, they need you to submit them all in a PDF. But this one needed you to submit them all in a zip file with the specific file title name of each thing in German. Anyway, it was It was a pain in the ass, I'll say. And it took me like an hour and a half to do all these like stupid little things at the end, like trying to understand. So anyway, that was done. We'll see. I think that my letter of motivation, Lorraine helped me with it. She helped edit it.
So it's fantastic.
I think I got good feedback from it. I had to translate it into Spanish as well as my CV, which I've never done before, which was an interesting experience. I'll give it that. To be honest, I think what I feel ambivalent at this point. Maybe I'm just from the kind of emotional hangover of the whole process, but I feel somewhat ambivalent about even doing this program now. I still have to do an interview, and then also an interview in Spanish. I'm not sure if it's gonna be at the same time. Like, there's gonna be like someone on Skype. I don't really know like how many interviews. I don't know. But thing is, it would be much more like me to just finish this master's degree and move there on my own. I've done that before, and I think that might be much more my aligned with my kind of personality. It would be great. It would be great to study. It would be great to experience yet another kind of university environment. Don't get me wrong, but yeah, at this point, like, it's not like I'm gonna let it stop me if I don't get it. And it was definitely a pretty intensive and exhausting process so far, and yeah, so I have to muster up my last bit of courage here to go tomorrow to the language center and find out what my grade is.
Good luck.
Thank you. Yeah, so that's what I did last week. So shall we discuss our topic of the day?
Yes, let's get right into the meat.
What is it? The cannibal, the human flesh.
I wasn't going to say it.
You planted it in my head. That's not fair.
Cannibalism on a train.
Yeah, so we wouldn't even have to change the acronym.
So, unrelated to cannibalism. this episode, we want to talk about one of the things about academia that we feel like there's some room for improvement in the general culture, and that is the way that academia structures itself around teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, I think it's fair to say that we both believe that perhaps academia should structure itself a little more around teaching.
Definitely. And by a little, we mean substantially more.
We mean phenomenally more.
Because, yeah, as of now, academia, the emphasis is much more heavily placed on research. And kind of the marker of someone's academic prowess and their candidature as an applicant to teach for a teaching position is actually their research output, which does not equal the other.
It makes about as much sense as if you hired a plumber based on how good their piano skills are.
Yeah, it doesn't translate. Oftentimes, academics, even if they're amazing researchers, have little to no training whatsoever in pedagogy, and a lot of them don't place much emphasis on it as important, but rather as a kind of requisite that they have to fulfill in order to maintain their research position in their professorship. And I've seen this at Cornell, which was oftentimes a mess. Like, we'd have some of the best researchers in their fields in the world, yet they didn't even, they use the same PowerPoints from years, and there's a huge gap between like what they were doing and then what would be on the exam, and like what, then we'd have like literally regularly like a 30-point curve because like what was that? Like, what are grades, man? Yeah, you'd go from having a C to an A+ because they just did a terrible job constructing the exam, and then a lot of the work would fall into the TAs who are also
not trained.
Exactly. So it's just perpetuating the same cycle. But you had something you wanted to say.
I have so many things.
So many things.
I mean, I think what doesn't necessarily come across in this dichotomization between research and teaching is that if you can't communicate your research to people, your research doesn't matter. And writing scientific articles is, yes, one way of communicating research. But another really good way is to go into a classroom and tell a bunch of people about it.
Yeah.
And if you lack the skill set for that, you fundamentally are not able to do your job as a researcher to the highest optimization.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. Yeah, and I think that there's almost this, like, in terms of labor and how we value labor, a kind of, like, almost an implicit bias against teaching as being, like, a worthy endeavor, in a sense, as opposed to research. You know what I mean? Like, research is also seen as this, like, much more legitimizing and, like, thing worthy of praise than, like, being a teacher, or that, like, a university that emphasizes its kind of teaching side is not, you know, like, because what makes it, like, all these Ivy League schools is that they have this major research output.
I think this is not unconnected to the total lack of support for public school educators, especially in North America, but, like, all over the place, really. Yeah. Complete failure to acknowledge how difficult that job is.
Yeah.
And the tendency, especially in American output, also in Canadian, to really diminish and belittle teachers.
Yes,
and
yes.
Teaching as a profession.
Hell yeah. And I think it's also, I would even extend it to the fact that, like, teaching is often, like, a job that many women do.
It's also not unconnected.
And the kind of way that we value and don't value certain forms of labor in general in our society. I think that all these things are connected and playing out, I think. And
then the expectation, because it's a quote-unquote feminine profession, is that teachers should also be, like, carers or babysitters.
Yeah.
And obviously at the university level, they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
We agree. But if that's the association that people have with teaching is caregiving, then of course people are not going to take it seriously.
Yeah, and I think on that note, there are some other things that we've been discussing as well in terms of the way that I've seen. I have in my sociology courses, like, certain professors who I really love hearing what they have to say, and they inspire me a lot, and I really enjoy their classes, but tend to seem to, like, kind of almost intentionally shun the certain more, like, interpersonal aspects of what I would expect of, but also what I think are, like, not just what I just expect them, but are kind of, like, reasonable things, such as, like, holding office hours, kind of feeling approachable and all these kinds of things. And we were talking about how it could be fair enough that, and I agree with this, but it sucks that the result is that it falls on students too, who kind of are feeling the lack of engagement in this aspect, but that they aren't really being compensated. This truly is extra work that they have to do that maybe they're not being compensated fairly for. So you can't really blame them, especially, like, this leftist sociology professor, like, for taking a stand on not wanting to do uncompensated labor. But then, as we've said, the way it's structured is that falls then on students to maybe not feel fully well received, or have the support from the professors that they would like.
So, to be clear, at no point in this episode do we want to say that professors should do more uncompensated labor by being better at teaching. What we are saying is that universities should compensate the labor of teaching better.
And by placing more value on it, by compensating it and just making that seem more of, like, a legitimate aspect of what it means to be a successful professor and researcher.
And this starts early in the academic project. You know, if undergrads are given the impression that their instructors care about their learning, then when they go off to grad school, they'll have the impression that that's what an instructor does.
Yeah, absolutely. There is another thing in this vein I was going to say about, we were saying being compensated. Oh, well, the other thing on this note too, which I think kind of picks up what we were talking about last episode in terms of, like, student-professor relationships, that at times it can also be difficult to, in terms of this kind of idea of that this expectation that they should, or, like, whether they should or shouldn't be caregivers. Also, that I think at this level of academia, the kind of relationships and, like, the way that students and teachers are supposed to interact with each other gets much more blurry, because we're older. I think that the kind of, at least in, like, social sciences and humanities, sometimes the conversation topics are, like, a little bit more personal and people are more vulnerable. Also, like, student-teacher relationships are already a power dynamic and there already is a vulnerability, but I think that is, like, less blatant because of the kind of filling in the gap of, like, the way that we talk to each other and, like, a blurring of, like, a sense of authority at times. And I think that that also can complicate this and, like, make people feel a lot of, like, weird professors feel weird liability where they can sometimes be very, like, aloof and, like, intentionally distant. And that can also feel weird. And I'm not sure how to navigate that because I get that it's, like, could be very fraught how they try to have interpersonal relationships with their students.
Yes, legally and emotionally fraught for all involved, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in a public school, secondary or elementary school, it's very clear like what the role of a teacher is and what the role of a student is. But especially once you get up to the graduate level, there is this like idea floating around that we are in fact colleagues.
Yeah.
That it is also, it runs against what we've been trained to do by our 15-16 years of public and bachelor education, which is to view teachers as an authority. And so I think it can be very difficult to draw boundaries, to figure out what the appropriate ways of interacting with your instructors are.
So that people feel comfortable both in not having the boundaries crossed, but also feeling some level of like interpersonal engagement. And then I think there's some interesting ways, because in terms of this idea that we're colleagues, I think that there's that kind of element floating around, but it's not necessarily universally kind of accepted by everybody.
Exactly. And everyone has kind of a different idea of what that entails.
Yeah. And like some things that we've talked about too, I think this is kind of interesting because these two things I'm about to say can seem like contradictory. But on one hand, I think that in my experience and from speaking with people, it seems to be that overall, the kind of approachability element is much more prevalent in the North American university model than it is in the Northern European model, or not even Northern European. I would say amongst German professors that there's this idea. Lorraine doesn't entirely agree. She's had just some different experiences, but that's been what I've seen amongst a lot of professors. And of course, I want to emphasize this isn't like a unilateral kind of, I'm not saying that, but like this kind of culture around it is that oftentimes there's more of a, however, like more of a distance or more of a kind of space between, like, for example, I had some ongoing relationships with professors outside of just the classroom where we would Skype regularly or meet for coffee or send emails sometimes after I graduated. And simultaneously, that said, I find that kind of a different cultural clash is that in terms of this idea of them like seeing professors as colleagues at this age, through this stage in education, that it's more kosher and more acceptable or even expected to challenge your professor's feedback in this in Europe, in Northern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
That I felt that both in when I was studying in Denmark as well as here, that's kind of expected. While simultaneously, for example, this North American professor from City University of New York who's visiting right now, and he gave me feedback, and I did that, he seemed really like that it was a bit inappropriate that I was challenging what he was his feedback or like not agreeing with his feedback about my paper. And so like, those kind of things don't seem to fit together, but I it's interesting to think about potentially maybe some differences in expectations from both hemispheres.
Yes, absolutely. And I couldn't possibly come up with a reason or a way to reconcile those, except possibly that German colleagues also think that you should challenge each other more and not necessarily be like friends.
Yeah, that can make sense actually. Yeah.
And so the collegiality doesn't necessarily translate into friendship in the way that it might from a North American perspective.
Yeah, that's
I'm just flinging that one right out there.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I'm going to agree with that when I think back on it.
Yeah, but it's a postulate that
it's
you just
thought.
Made. Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, what else do we have about...
Well, I would like to talk about how we think we could fix this.
Yeah. I think you have a lot there.
I have many ideas. I've given this a lot of thought. Actually, I'm going to go off.
Go off. I went off in the last episode. It's your turn.
Yay! This is the Lorraine episode. I'm going to go off roasting the University of Bamberg. Sorry. Sorry, people at Bamberg who did the best.
Listening to this, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe. My experience at the University of Bamberg was that there was no support for good teaching. And the way that this played out is that people graduated from the master's degree at Bamberg, went into the PhD, and had only been taught in kind of a weak way, and so they only knew how to teach in kind of a weak way. Mm. And I don't blame either them or the previous instructors for this. What I blame is the fact that there was no institutional support for them to be trained in pedagogy so as to improve their teaching.
Mm.
And what I want to say is that you don't learn how to be a good teacher by being a student.
Mm.
And you certainly don't learn how to be a good teacher by being a student of teachers who are not that good. You know, that's just a fact. How are you supposed to pick up how to deliver a really good lecture if you only see kind of shoddy lectures?
And then it just, the cycle really perpetuates itself, I think is an important point here too.
Exactly.
It's the blind leading the blind.
Exactly. And if the structure of academia doesn't reward teaching, if it only rewards research, then who's going to go out of their way to learn how to be a better teacher? I think often teachers don't even realize that they're not doing a great job.
Yeah.
Because they don't have a good point of reference. People do entire PhDs in education.
Yeah.
To learn how to be pedagogues.
Pedagogues?
Pedagogues?
Sounds right.
Does it?
It's like a demagogue.
People do entire PhDs in education to learn pedagogy.
Mm-hmm.
And to improve that. And none of that is crossing over into how we are trained to teach university students.
Are we even trained?
We are not. We are literally not. You know, we don't really have master students as teaching assistants in our program, but in a North American program where master students are teaching assistants, they can quite literally be the teacher of a class that they were in 6 months ago. That is bonkers.
Yeah, that's absolutely fucking wild.
That's honestly not okay.
Yeah.
And the fact that this is accepted.
Yeah, it's just chaos, really.
It just shows how devalued this part of the process is.
Yeah.
So what I am saying is that to fix this, what we need to do is train our teachers. Like, it should be a piece of graduate education to at least go to some workshops on pedagogy.
Yeah.
Like, a block seminar.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah, seriously. Like, even that would be a huge step.
Yes.
Yeah.
Unless someone is going out of their way to learn how to do pedagogy by reading books that are mainly meant for, you know, secondary school. Like, that's what most pedagogy research that I've found is about.
It's about.
People just are not equipped with the skills.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very well said. Trying to think, what else is there to say?
This also filters into issues about how instructors deal with students in non-classroom settings in terms of having sensitivity to them and knowing how to navigate relationships that the student, or knowing how to navigate problems that the students may come to them with.
Yeah, because again, as we've already said, like, the dynamics can be vulnerable, and I think, I don't know, I'm still working out why it is, but I think students, even in, I mean, of course, I don't need to argue that students in primary school, students in secondary school are vulnerable oftentimes as young people, but I think actually students that are doing their bachelor's and their master's and their PhDs are vulnerable, potentially in different ways, but still vulnerable, mm-hmm. I think, and it's totally normal that, and I really am a believer we need to talk more and be more sensitive, and that needs to be the direction we need to go in, that, like, with that, and that students are oftentimes dealing with things, and that's also playing into their performance, and that it's likely, therefore, that at times students might confide in professors or seek support or guidance beyond purely academic-related topics mm-hmm. from their professors. And I understand, like, that can be a difficult, as we've already said, they're not necessarily being compensated for it. They maybe have zero training in how to, but these are things that, again, that, like, go back into what we've already said about how they should be compensated for it. They should be trained, at least at minimum, to know how to help that student be directed where they need to go.
Exactly.
And then, but then there needs to also actually be something at the other end of that. Because that's maybe step two of this point that we're making about, having better kind of resources for students, not only as better pedagogy, but also potentially better support resources.
I guess this is just to say that I hope to soon be in front of a classroom.
Yeah, you're meant for it. You're going to be great at that.
Thank you.
Definitely, definitely.
And it's really important to me, actually. Yeah. This is something I've communicated, that during my PhD, like, teaching is the thing that I need to be doing. Because I've done research.
Yeah.
I know how to do that. I need lots of practice, definitely. Mm-hmm. But I know what the steps are. Mm-hmm. I do not know how to set up a syllabus. I do not know how to manage a classroom.
Yeah.
I do not know how to construct an exam.
Yeah.
And because there is no class for it, I will not know until I am doing
it. Just thrown into it. And I agree with that, actually. I've always, like, really enjoyed and felt like called to working with youth and to this kind of development, and I've worked extensively, actually. It doesn't come out very much, but extensively with young people from like 5 to 15 in various capacities. But I feel like it really also kind of, it's unfortunate that I've lost what probably could have been like taken that and that experience and talent I might have had and then like transferred to this setting, you know. Mm-hmm. I feel like that there's been something, you know, which is getting into what we're saying, you know, harnessing people's potential for being good at teaching. Also, I think we've talked about our aspirations as academics and how, I think what we were saying is that we'd be happy, or we were talking about, like, I think we're speaking about how, like, you'd be happy with working at a university that was, like, a lot to do with teaching, right? Was this what we were saying? Is that was, like, your university?
My university in Canada was very teaching-focused. I have, you know, obviously, as academics, we don't necessarily have options about what kind of university we end up at, so whatever.
Yeah.
But the university I was at in Canada, University of Prince Edward Island, shout out, was extremely teaching-focused. And it was excellent. Mm. My program was excellent. I would not be as good at anything as I am if I had not been in such a teaching-focused and supportive program that really put the students first.
That's really cool.
And so if I end up in a position where my academic career allows me to be in that kind of job, I will be happy.
Right. Because, yeah, again, I mean, I think that it's so important, you know? I think that, yeah, it's really sad because I feel especially for, I'm thinking of, like, my high school English teachers, for example, but I think the same can go for the university level. Like, they're doing such important work, and we don't value them where they deserve to be valued. Like, they change lives of people, and they inspire people to alter the path that they're on, like, for the better, you know? And that's really powerful. And yeah, it's wrong that part of the job is not seen as,
And not only is it not compensated, like, by the powers that be within the university, but there is such a discourse of negativity around teaching responsibilities.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time in graduate student forums online. And the amount of negativity I see, especially from students in the sciences, I've noticed, but also there are just more of them on many of these forums, so I don't know. The resentment that they show that they're expected to teach makes me angry.
Yeah. It's because it's really toxic. Again, when we talk about how these things are really cyclical and they're kind of like perpetuating the same issues. Mm-hmm. And then when that's also like injected with like this really negative and like resentful, it's not making us the best we could be.
No, and this is not to say that I think everyone should be a teacher, like, not at all. But frankly, if you're not willing to teach, if you're not excited about that part of your job, then you should not be in academia, because yeah. that's what the job is.
Yeah, that's, yeah, seriously.
If all you want is to be in a lab doing experiments, like, go to a pharmaceutical company. I'm sure they would like to have you.
I won't approve of that, but...
You know,
I don't have to approve of everything that you're doing, dear listener.
We're not here to kink shame.
Not here to kink shame you. Yeah, so...
Do you want to do what we've been reading?
Yeah, what have we been reading? Man, I've read two. I'm not going to get too into them, but I've read two really, really awesome things recently. One of them is Conscripts of Modernity by, what is his first name? I think it's David Scott. Amazing book. Fascinating. We've had some really good conversations about it. It's basically just to give a short kind of summary of his thesis. It's basically about how he's looking at C.L.R. James's The Black Jacobins and talking about the way that post-colonial struggles are so embedded in the epistemologies and historiographies of modernity, which they've inherited from the colonial period, that it's like very difficult, if not potentially impossible, to arrive at any true vision of emancipatory or transformative change. And it's an amazing book. It's because I've been looking for something like this for a long time, because I study a lot and am engaged in social movements, and I think that this is an issue, the way that we're so embedded in the same thoughts or just trying to resist what it is rather than being able to have the tools and the intellectual space to think of something radically new. But also it's really fascinating sort of from like a literary perspective, because he talks about some of the ways that we filter renditions of true events and history are borrowed from these like deeply ingrained sort of templates for stories, such as the tragedy or the romance, and how then that also shapes our ideas of how we conceive what's possible or the trajectories on which like real events happen. And then also the kind of relationship between a real event and then the way that it's told, which is always stylized, even if it's fiction, or sorry, even if it's nonfiction or the news or, yeah. So it's there's a lot to take from this book.
I really love that. I cannot wait to read this book.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I downloaded the PDF.
Yeah.
The way in which history is told is of enormous interest to me, and especially stylizations of history.
Yeah, I bet. I think that could potentially even come up in your current research.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. It's very much to do with my prospective PhD.
Yes. Topic. Yeah. Exactly. So it could be really useful. The other book, I'm not going to get into it in this episode, but the other book that I'm reading is fiction is 2666 by Roberto Bolaño, and. Yeah, it's one of the most, I don't really even have words for it. I'll talk about it in another episode.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned.
And be recording another episode in a minute. Yeah. So. I have been reading a book that I actually bought when I first moved to Berlin. Actually, I first saw it in a bookstore when I came here to visit with my best friend from Canada when I was considering coming to FU. Mm. We went to a bookstore and I saw this book and I was like, when I move here, I'm going to buy that book.
Aw, that's so cute.
And then I did. And then I didn't read it until this year.
What is the book?
It's called Gay Berlin. So on brand.
Naturally.
So phenomenally on brand. If I were a book... This is a book. And it's the history of the gay visibility and rights movements in Berlin between sort of the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the Nazis. Which is, you know, a fascinating
time.
It is a roller coaster ride.
People were manic. We've said this before.
Oh, it doesn't even begin to describe it. It is actually, I've learned a couple of things that are related to my Victorian research, because some of the scholars that it talks about are scholars who I read, like, historically, like Richard von Krafft-Ebing.
Cool.
And then it gets into the 20th century and another period of my interest, although not my primary research.
So adjacent.
It's adjacent. So it was a really fantastic thing to have read. I finished it yesterday.
Nice. Yeah. Love reading. So much to read. Did you know, did I tell you someone gifted me their copy of Tar by Wyndham Lewis? We haven't talked about Wyndham Lewis at all this season. Yeah, they just gave it to me.
Oh my god, where
it's
is
over
it?
There. It's over there. It's over there. It's one of those Penguin classics.
Oh my god.
Yeah, they just gave it to me. I don't know. I haven't really been. I just haven't even let myself engage in like what that's supposed to mean.
They know but... you. Can we have a podcast episode that's just us reading Tar?
Yeah.
Out loud?
Yeah. Dramatic yeah, reading? Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And then can
yeah.
we read other works by Wyndham Lewis?
Other works by Wyndham Lewis.
The complete works of Wyndham Lewis.
So that's our other podcast. It's like our a spinoff podcast. Just us reading. It's only.
Am I going to bleep his name?
We're going to have to bleep his name out. yeah, so I think that wraps it up for episode 11 of Coat Podcast.
Thank you for joining us on another wild ride.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. If you have thoughts about how academia could improve their pedagogy or their emphasis on pedagogy, feel free to write to us on your favorite media platform of your choice. I never say it as well as she does.
Please write to us on the social media platform of your choice. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, although actually Instagram is the only one where we have an account.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The Twitter is not us. Be careful.
Well, yeah. For a while you had in your...
I had it in my bio. Turns out there's speaking like from experience.
A completely unrelated...
Coat Podcast. God can... Who knows what that's about? Coat Podcast.
I think there it stands for coolest of all time.
No.
Which is...
Ours can stand for that.
I mean, that's the
it
secret...
It goes without saying, man.
Secret acronym. That's yeah. neither caffeinated on a train nor cannibals on a train.
Cannibals on a train. Inside joke from episode 10.
No, that was from this one.
This is from this episode?
Yes.
Oh, no. We're going to cut that out.
It feels so
we're not recording though. Multiple episodes at once. I don't know what you're talking about. Anyways, also, feel free to lend your support to young women in academia via our Patreon account.
Link in bio.
Link in bio. Along with descriptions about... cannibalism and
links to everything that we've said we'd link to in this episode and
possibly some other things too. So anyways, bye.